We are thrilled to welcome to Studio A Glenn Berger. Glenn is the author of the new book, Song of Spider-Man, the inside story of the most controversial musical in Broadway history. The book follows the troubled production of the Julie Taymor-directed and U2-orchestrated Broadway show Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, which was plagued from the beginning by technical difficulties. Glenn Berger was the co-writer of the play and is here to tell us about how he got the job, what went right, what went very, very wrong. And he is an Emmy Award-winning television and theater writer and, again, the author of the new book, Song of Spider-Man. Glenn Berger, a delight to have you here. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thrilled to be here. Thank you.
So you live semi-locally, so it's...
Yes. I was living in Woodstock during this whole saga, and then we just moved a little north.
You get involved in this... let's say an unconventional route, right? This whole thing comes together and you are brought on at what stage in the development of Spider-Man?
Yeah, you know, Tony Adams, who was a producer from Ireland, managed to convince Marvel to let him produce Spider-Man. This was back in 2002 or 2003, and being Irish, Tony went over to Ireland and convinced compatriots Bono and Edge to write the score. And Bono and Edge said, "Oh well, you know, just down the street is Neil Jordan, the filmmaker. Maybe he'd like to write the script." And he signed on, and then Neil knew Julie Taymor through Elliot Goldenthal, her partner, the composer. And so now Julie was on board. And then Neil Jordan turned in an outline that Julie thought was just a little too cinematic, not theatrical enough. So he was let go. And so now they needed a new book writer. And that's how I came aboard. They looked for, you know, they asked about 9 playwrights to sort of submit a sample scene.
So give us a sense, and you write about this beautifully in the book, but give us a sense of how much was on you and how much you had to comply with the Marvel standard of the story of Spider-Man.
There's a lot of other people's needles that you have to thread. early on, I kind of twigged onto that, you know, that this wasn't going to be Glenn Berger's Spider-Man. It was going to be Marvel Spider-Man. It was going to be Julie's Spider-Man. And so I sort of had to turn my radio dial to her frequency pretty early on. Julie had a certain number of things that she wanted in the show, or else she wasn't interested. You know, she didn't want to do just a by-the-numbers Spider-Man. And so she and Marvel actually had to sort of come to some sort of understanding because she wanted this supervillain Arachne in the story. And Arachne wasn't in the traditional Marvel supervillain canon, so they had to negotiate a little bit.
And ultimately, in what we see on Broadway now, not much a part of the show.
Right. No, not much apart. And that got definitely scaled back.
We'll get to that in a moment. But as far as the collaboration of everyone, man, this looks good on paper.
Yeah. No, it did look...
Like, what could go wrong with this?
What could possibly go wrong? Of course, Murphy's Law definitely
so
came into play.
There's what we know of. And what we read, and of course the hype, and which was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But was there a much earlier point that you got a sense of I don't know about this?
No. On the contrary, it like you said, it all looked amazing on paper, and then we had this workshop reading in 2007, and it was just everyone in a room together, and it just went. Just gangbusters, the producers, the investors, everyone thought that we had a blockbuster and we had nothing to worry about. We had rehearsals in 2010 and they all looked like, all indications were that this thing was going to fly. And I think, once you got into tech and we had to deal with certain realities when it came to hardware, that we began to, run into trouble.
One of the things that I love about the book is that you tell the story. It does not seem like you have an axe to grind really with anyone. And I find that admirable and quite frankly surprising. I would think that, I would think you would come out of this experience somewhat scathed. But
these were all good people who were just doing what they, were felt needed doing. This wasn't about character assassination. Here's the thing: I'm a writer, and all good writing has to be about, really, at the end of the day, getting inside of other people's heads and figuring out, what their motivations are. And so this wasn't, I guess a typical tell-all maybe isn't written so much by a writer, but just someone who happened to be on the scene. I happen to be on the scene, but I also happen to be not just a major character in the book, but also by profession a writer. So I from the very beginning of writing this book, I took it as my job to do that.
To tell the story. Yeah. If it seemed that in the press, certainly, that if anyone came out to be the bad guy in it, it was Julie Tamer.
Sure.
In reading your book, I mean, certainly there are some questionable decisions. But you almost point the finger more to you two, Bono and Edge, of not having, being very hands-on, always being away, not being there when you needed them, and kind of having a detachment to a project that they were so wrapped up in.
Well, yeah, to an extent, I hope even that doesn't completely come across in the book. It wasn't their fault so much that they weren't there. They were on this tour that just went on forever, and originally we were supposed to go up in 2009, and then we ran out of money, and new producers had to come on, and it took another year to find that money. They weren't traditional Broadway composers, and that they didn't have days and days on end to spend in rooms, although we did early on spend a lot of time in rooms together, and then later on when we were in previews, just because of their schedule, they were thousands of miles away. But at the same time, they were sending people in, every day to watch the show. And also, we weren't so clear at that time that the music and the lyrics were so much the problem, as the story.
And you talk about previews. This is 7 months of previews. Most Broadway shows, what, 2-3 weeks?
Yeah. Well, like I said, I was living in Woodstock, so my wife and three kids were... I abandoned them for months.
So was it during the preview time that you realized, okay, this isn't all... because it seems to be the turning point is when the injuries started.
Well, yeah, what the injuries did was kind of set those very hot media lamps on us. The injuries themselves were, I'm not going to say minor, but they were, they happen in lots of shows, but we got a whole lot of press for it, and it began to seem, I take my kids to that Dutchess County Fair, where there's that mad science exhibit, and that that's kind of what I think, my kids are on the edge of their seats because he's watching this, they're watching this scientist pour these different chemicals into one beaker, and I think that was what was going on, that they didn't know if is it just going to turn purple or is it going to explode, I think all these different elements, Bono and Edge and Julie Taymor and Spider-Man and musical, just people were on the edge of their seat wanting to see, was this just going to turn purple or was it going to explode? And so what we had was a situation where we couldn't really focus on doing our best work because we had all these other sort of outsiders, focusing these hot lamps on us.
Is $65 million, is that an accurate figure?
Well,
not that you would ever know that.
No, I mean, Michael Cole, the producer, he at a certain point just... began to shrug and laugh every time any figure was mentioned because, you know, someone somewhere was keeping track, but no one else was. You know, the general managers probably have a pretty good idea. But yeah, 65, call it 65, but, you know, there's a lot
It was a lot of money.
Yeah, then, you know, you throw in the loans on top of that and other things on top of that. It wasn't just the show that cost that much. We had to spend on rent in a dark theater for a year while the producers were trying to raise more money. We had just rented the largest theater on Broadway and then kept it dark for a year. So,
and a beautiful theater, and you are retrofitting it for this major production that you hope is going to be around for a long time, and it has been. But it's a lot of infrastructure.
Yeah, well, they started renovating it, plaster raining down, and then David Garfinkel, the original producer, runs out of money. In fact, he's about $20 million short suddenly, and we had a theater that no one could use. And so, yeah, for about 9 or 10 months, it just sat dark, and more money was thrown into just paying the rent on the thing. And so that jacked up the price tag. You know, you don't see all that $65 million on the stage.
So it at some point, things like somebody came in, and I don't know, well, you write about it in the book, but they come in and they say, look, this is enough is enough. And Julie Taymor goes bye-bye, and another writer is brought in. And how do you feel about all of this? Because it is your baby, and it's something that you've been working on for a long time. It's very, you know, it's like the troubled kid, and you want to see it work out well. But by the same token, I assume you wanted to see it through to the end.
Oh, yeah. Well, we, you know, about 3 weeks into previews, I began to get a real sense that this thing was going to close imminently if something drastic wasn't done. It didn't even enter our minds that this thing wouldn't run for years and years and years. We kept talking about all the other productions and the movie that was going to be made out of the show. So we couldn't. There were definitely people in the theater that couldn't wrap their brains around the idea that this thing was going to shut. And if you aren't convinced that the thing is going to close, then you're not going to do anything really drastic to try to save it, you know. But we all thought we had this beautiful show with a heart problem, you know, like a child that was going to die, and so you needed a heart transplant. So I started coming up with various plans, solutions to, you know, to at least buy us some time. And, you know, but there was a lot of heads being knocked together trying to, you know, come to some sort of consensus. And we never came to consensus. And eventually, you know, by March, a new team was brought in.
And so when you see the final, the thing that's running now,
sure,
the show that's running now, is it possible for you to say this percentage of it is my work?
Oh, well, yeah. You know, I mean, I was, well, yes and no. When Roberto Aguirre Sacasa came on to be the new co-book writer, he basically replaced Julie. So I was still there from March up until opening night. And, you know, we worked together on a new version. But again, you know, there were more needles to thread. Now the new director, Phil McKinley, you know, had his own needle that we had to thread. It's 80% mine, it's 20% mine, you know, in terms of, you know, what I would have done had I just
been able to do it,
yeah, even 6 years ago. So it's all, every moment is fraught with, you know, emotion for me.
You try to put this in words, and you succeed, I think, beautifully in the book, but it seems to me a hard thing to try to, you know, this has your name on it, and it's out there, and it's a big deal. It's still making money.
Yes,
it's doing well. I mean, I've seen the thing 3 times. I love it. I think it's a great way to introduce kids to theater. I think it works on many levels. It had some fantastic performances. But how do you feel about it now? I mean, do you look at it and say, I'm proud to have my name associated with this? Or at some point in your life, you'll drop it from the resume?
Oh, no, it's a wild thing. You know, it has grossed over my resume. It's grossed over $200 million. It's something like the 17th highest grossing Broadway show of all time.
Yeah.
And for me, it's not even a show anymore. It's transcended that. You know, it's become one of these kind of large... you know, aspects of my biography. You know, in my deathbed, I'll be thinking of it, but not as a show, but as, wow, that was quite an episode.
And this is impossible to know, but don't you think that a lot of what continues now of why people want to see it is because of that episode, because of what happened?
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. It was. You know, from the beginning, and I say it in the book, you know, it was always meant to be a spectacle, but it became, you know, a spectacle that sort of transcended, you know, that went beyond the boundaries of the stage, you know, that it was just one of those sort of cultural moments, you know. And
I would assume, you know, early on in the process, when you're going through tech and so forth, and people are flying around the theater, that part of the reason that we want to see that is that element of danger, right? You talked about the circus of being at the edge of your seat. You want that. And yet, so when it becomes real and there is something that goes wrong, which is inevitable because it's technology and people have to be at the right place at the right time. And is that going to work every night, however, eight shows a week?
Yeah.
So, and the answer, of course, is that it should, but will it? Does that... You always want that, and then when there became such an uproar and a fuss over the concerns, did that kind of take away that you became almost, not you personally, but the show became sort of overprotective of itself?
Well, yeah, you know, there was, you know, there was that rubbernecking quality for
right.
a while where people, you know, some people did want to see the show because, you know, with the same reason people sometimes want to go see NASCAR. And, you know, and that it shouldn't really be that way if we're talking about a play. So it did have that quality. You know, I guess you don't really want to feel the danger so much as you go to the theater, you know, really to feel more alive. Something needs to feel live and immediate, and so when they're flying over your heads, the sensation is just not oh he could fall, but more wow that's happening right now, you know, and the nowness of theater is really what we were going for. But yeah, you know, at a certain point. We did want to just kind of get into the routine of, you know, we didn't have an accident in this many number of days, and you just want things to sort of be uneventful, you know, behind the scenes.
You described this scene of, there's a chapter in the book called Breakdowns, and where the actors are like sort of near mutiny, right? Is that safe to say?
Yeah, they were exhausted. Everyone was exhausted.
So Patrick Page, who plays the Green Goblin, gets up and says, reminds everyone that the previous day was the winter solstice, the darkest day of the year, in a rare conjunction last night during the show, the moon was erased by a total lunar eclipse. The dark and turn off the dark has never seemed more appropriate, but from this day forward, daylight slowly returns to the earth. And I can just imagine him saying that in that voice of his, which is like the voice of God anyway, that's sort of where things turned, isn't it?
Yes. Well, it turned, for in any number of ways.
Right.
That's where it turned, because it was really that day that I realized this show has more problems than I think many of us understand. And people, the actors really were expecting after that winter break that the creative people would come back with solutions that were going to keep not just the show running but keep them employed.
So I've read an interview, and we're just about out of time, but I found this to be a great story and very telling of your experience, which is so not that long ago Julie Taymor calls you. You look down, you see it's her, and you figure like she butt dialed you, and you don't do anything. And then it goes to voicemail, and you realize that she does want to talk to you. And then like you have to lawyer that.
Yeah.
That gives you a sense of what had transpired over that period of time.
Yeah. Well, that's really what the book is about. Ultimately, at the end is how can you go from, it's about really any collaboration, human beings working together. And how can you go from a place of such intimacy and creativity to a place, where you have to call a lawyer before you can take a call.
Yeah. And she ultimately was worried about the book, of what it would say about you, about what it would say about her.
She's, am I going to have to worry about this book, she said. And I told her, I don't think so, because, I do the utmost love and respect for her.
And meanwhile, she claims to have not have read it, which you assume was the response that you would get. I at least that's what I would assume.
Yeah, well, she's been working on Midsummer Night's Dream, and she doesn't get distracted very easily by other things.
Yeah. And you still have respect for her as a director and as an artistic talent?
Oh, hell yes. She's amazing in every way. And we were all put under a strange, pressure cooker, NASA built, type of situation that, that I think, we were suddenly in a land that nobody, could recognize. And, so we had to try to figure out how to make it work.
So your second act, you do what now? How do you follow that up? I assume you want it to be quiet.
It was the whole experience was a spiritual practice at the end of the day, and my hope is that I can actually use this as a way to navigate this world with a little bit more adroitness next time.
It's no offense to anyone who listens to the show that I'm a huge Broadway fan and a theater nerd, but I love every page of this book. It's just great stuff, and you tell an amazing story, and you're a beautiful storyteller and a beautiful writer. And I thank you so much for coming here and being with us. And best of luck in the future stuff.
My pleasure.
And if things go really really right or really really wrong, we want you to come back and tell us about them.
Absolutely. Although I don't think I'll do another tell-all book.
The name of the book is Song of Spider-Man, The Inside Story of the Most Controversial Musical in Broadway History. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Glenn Berger, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll say our goodbyes right after this short break.